Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. Coming up, Andrew Smith presents Ask a Teacher. We also have Words and Their Stories from Anna Mateo. And we close the show with an American story. But first,
celebrations across the United States are taking place to mark National Hispanic Heritage Month. It is a yearly tradition that honors the diversity and culture of Hispanic people. The month-long period is a chance for many in the U.S. to learn about what Hispanics have given to American culture. It is celebrated each year from September 15th to October 15th. The group includes people whose ancestors come from Spain, Mexico, the Caribbean, and Central and South America. The latest census estimates there are more than 65 million people identified as ethnically Hispanic in the U.S. Before there was National Hispanic Heritage Month, there was Hispanic Heritage Week. President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the law in 1968. The U.S. Library of Congress says every president since Johnson has issued a proclamation for National Hispanic Heritage Month. On September 13th, President Joe Biden issued a proclamation recognizing September 15th through October 15th as National Hispanic Heritage Month. Rachel Gonzalez-Martin is an associate professor of Mexican American and Latino Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She said the celebration has grown over the past 10 years because of the larger number of Latinos in the U.S. She noted that Hispanic Heritage Month was an official recognition of belonging that became really powerful. September 15th is the date when some Latin American countries mark their independence days. The Central American nations of Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Costa Rica celebrate their independence on September 15th. Mexico marks its national day on September 16th. Also, during National Hispanic Heritage Month, the South American nation of Chile observes its Independence Day on September 18th. Alberto Lammers is Director of Communications at the UCLA Latino Policy and Politics Institute. He said, "It became a chance for people to know Hispanic cultures, for Latinos to get to know a community better, and for the American public to understand a little better the long history of Latinos in the U.S." Lammers said, "The four-week period is about honoring the way Hispanic populations have shaped the U.S. in the past and present. It gives us a chance to acknowledge how Latinos have been part of this nation for so many centuries," Lammers said. "I think that's what is great about this. It has allowed us to really dig deeper and a chance to tell our stories." Hispanic is a pre-existing term the federal government began using in the 1970s. For people whose ancestors came from Spanish-speaking cultures. But some people do not like the term Hispanic. They use other terms like Latino or Latinx, which mean different things to different groups. Events marking National Hispanic Heritage Month are planned in places from California to New York. I'm Jill Robbins.
Hello. This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Mohammad Reza about the usage of the words avant-garde and vanguard. Dear teacher, could you please explain the meaning of avant-garde and vanguard? And what's the difference? Thank you for writing to us, Mohammad Reza. I'm happy to answer this question. We use both of these words to help us describe new ways of doing things or the people involved in those new methods. However, we can use vanguard for more situations than avant-garde. Avant-garde mostly describes the newest styles in the arts, such as writing, music, painting, and filmmaking. It can also describe the people who make those styles. Consider these examples.
To some listeners, the music of avant-garde composers may sound strange. Her paintings fit within the avant-garde style of the 1960s.
We usually use the definite article the before avant-garde to describe the people involved in the new style, as in the following example.
This style of filmmaking became popular among the avant-garde.
Note that we can use avant-garde as either a noun or an adjective. However, vanguard is almost always a noun. The vanguard often refers to the people leading new developments. When we use the term the vanguard, we usually use the prepositions at, in, or among before it, as in these examples.
The research team works at the vanguard of computer science. The university students were in the vanguard of political change. She is among the vanguard of doctors supporting the new treatment.
Vanguard also means the advance guard of an army that goes ahead of the main group. Both avant-garde and vanguard come from the French language. In fact, English has hundreds of words that come from French. Some examples include coup d'etat, chef, chic, and chauffeur. For our readers and listeners, do you have a question about American English? Perhaps you would like to know how American English has changed over the years. Or maybe you just need to know how to use particular words. Whatever your question may be, send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Andrew Smith.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Swimming is a great exercise for staying healthy, but it can also be a life-saving skill and help to keep you from drowning. However, in some bodies of water, swimming might be difficult. For example, in very deep, choppy, or fast-moving water, swimming can be hard and even dangerous. Choppy water has many small, fast, close waves, usually created by wind. Water currents and tides can be very strong. It is easier to swim with them and not so easy to swim against them. On today's show, we talk about several English expressions that use swim to describe different ways to face a situation, especially danger, difficulty, or any hardship. Let's start with swimming in rivers. Let's say you jump in a river and swim downstream. That means you are swimming with the current of the water. This makes swimming easier and faster. So the expression to swim downstream means using the easy way to get something done. However, when you swim upstream, you have to fight the flow of the water. In some rivers or other bodies of water, swimming upstream is nearly impossible. As an expression, swimming upstream means you take a more difficult path to do something. You make it harder for yourself. Here's an example.
Dealing with money is not my strong suit. In fact, last year I was drowning in debt. Every month when bills arrived, I felt like I was swimming upstream. So I went to a financial advisor. Now I'm free of debt and staying on a budget.
Now, if you are swimming in the ocean, sea, or other large body of water, you may be fighting the tide. Swimming against the tide is another expression. It means you are fighting against very powerful forces. And odds are you will not come out the winner. Swimming with the tide or current is much easier. Again, this means you have taken an easier path. You have chosen an easier way to do something. All of these expressions can be used another way. They can also mean that you are going with or against popular opinions or viewpoints. If you are swimming with the tide or current, or swimming downstream, you act the same way as the majority of others. You are going with the flow. That is another common expression, to go with the flow. People who go with the flow are easygoing. They take the popular path without protest. However, swimming upstream and swimming against the tide or current mean the opposite. You are rejecting a popular idea, behavior, or opinion. You are acting against the way the majority of people are acting. Swimming against the tide is harder. In a sense, you are an outsider or outcast. You do not have the support of the current or of other people. Here is an example. If all of your friends are getting married and moving to quiet areas, you may feel the urge to swim with the tide and do the same. Or you could swim against the tide and stay in your small apartment in the center of a busy city with lots of bars and restaurants nearby. And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
You just heard Words and Their Stories from Ana Mateo. Ana joins us now to talk a little bit more about this week's expressions. Welcome, Ana.
Hello, Katie. Thanks for having me.
I know that you love to swim. So can you tell us more about these swimming expressions?
Yes, I love to swim. So writing about these swimming expressions was a lot of fun and useful. As you know, large bodies of water often have strong currents or tides. If you swim with the current or tide, you can swim more easily. But if you swim against them, that is much harder and possibly even dangerous.
And the same can be said for other situations.
That's right. Let's take work, for example. If someone always makes work harder for themselves by trying to do too much or missing deadlines, you can say they are swimming against the current.
And what about swimming downstream or upstream?
Same idea, different body of water. Those expressions come from swimming in a river that has streams rather than tides. If you are swimming upstream, you are making things difficult for yourself.
These expressions also have a different meaning. They can mean that you choose to reject the popular way of doing things or thinking.
That's right. Used this way, you are making things perhaps a little harder on yourself by being different from those around you.
Well, Anna, it was again a pleasure having you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Katie.
From VOA Learning English, this is American Stories. Our story is called The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky. It was written by Stephen Crane. We will listen to the story in two parts. Today, we will hear the first part of the story.
The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky. The great train was rushing forward, such steady dignity of motion that a glance from the window seemed to simply prove that the flatlands of Texas were pouring toward the east. A newly married pair had come on this train in San Antonio. The man's face was reddened from many days in the wind and sun. His roughened hands were continually moving over his new black clothes in a most nervous manner. From time to time, he looked down respectfully at his suit. He sat with a hand on each knee like a man waiting in a shop for a haircut. The glances he gave to other passengers were few and quick. The bride was not pretty, nor was she very young. She wore a dress of blue with many buttons. She continually turned her head to regard some part or other of her dress. It made her feel strange. One could tell that she had cooked and that she expected to cook dutifully. The searching glances of some of the passengers as she had entered the car had brought the blood rushing to her face. Her uncomfortable expression was strange to see upon this plain face, which was usually calm and almost emotionless. They were evidently very happy.
"Ever been in a train like this before?"
he asked, smiling with delight.
"No," she answered. "I never was. It's fine, isn't it?"
"Great. After a while, we'll go forward to the dining car and get a big dinner. Finest meal in the world. Costs a dollar."
"Oh, it does?" cried the bride. "A dollar? Oh, that's too much for us, isn't it, Jack?"
"Not on this trip, at least," he answered bravely. "We're going to enjoy ourselves."
Later, he explained to her about the trains.
"You see, it's 1,000 miles from one end of Texas to the other. The train runs straight across it and only stops 4 times. He had the pride of an owner.
He pointed out to her the beauty of the car they were riding in. And in truth, her eyes opened wider as she observed the rich sea-green cloth covering the seats, the shining silver and glass, the wood that shone darkly like the surface of a pool of oil. To the minds of the pair, their surroundings repeated the glory of their wedding that morning in San Antonio. This was the spirit of their new life, and the man's face in particular shone with a joy that made him appear foolish to certain passengers. In the minds of some, there was supposed to be something hugely funny in the pair's situation. "We're due in Yellow Sky at 3:42, he said, looking tenderly into her eyes.
"Oh, are we?"
she said, as if she had not been aware of it, to show surprise that her husband's remark was part of her wifely duty. She took from her pocket a little silver watch. As she held it before her and stared at it with a look of attention, the new husband's face shone. "I bought it in San Antonio from a friend of mine," he told her proudly.
"It's 12:17,
she said, looking up at him with a happy expression which, nevertheless, showed a lack of experience in conversing with men. A passenger, observing her small nervousness, laughed to himself. At last they went to the dining car. The man serving their table happened to take pleasure in directing them through their meal. He viewed them with the manner of a fatherly guide, his face shining with kindness. But they did not understand his attentions. As they returned to their seats, they showed in their faces a sense of escape. It was evident that, as the distance from Yellow Sky grew shorter, the husband became more nervous. His red hands were even more noticeable. He was rather absent-minded and far away when the bride leaned forward and spoke to him. As a matter of truth, Jack Potter was beginning to find his deed weighing upon him like a great stone. He, the town policeman of Yellow Sky, was a man known, liked, and feared in his community. He, an important person, had gone to San Antonio to meet a girl he believed he loved, and there he had actually married her without discussing any part of the matter with Yellow Sky. He was now bringing his bride to a sure-to-be-surprised town. Of course, people in Yellow Sky married as it pleased them, but Potter's thoughts of his duty to his friends, or of their idea of his duty, made him feel he was sinful. He was guilty of a great and unusual crime. Face to face with this girl in San Antonio, he had leaped all over the social fences. At San Antonio, he was like a man hidden in the dark. A knife to cut any friendly duty was easy to take in his hand in that distant city. But the hour of Yellow Sky, the hour of daylight, was approaching. He knew very well that his wedding was an important thing to the town. It could only be equaled by the burning of the new hotel. His friends could not forgive him, he felt. And now the train was hurrying him toward a scene of surprise, merriment, and blame. He glanced out of the window again. Yellow Sky had a kind of band which played its horns and drums painfully to the delight of the people. He laughed without heart as he thought of it. If the citizens could dream of his arrival with his bride, they would march the band at the station and accompany them among cheers and laughter to his house. He decided that he would use all methods of speed and cleverness in making the journey from the station to his house. Once safely at home, he would announce the news. Then he would not go among the citizens until they had had time to master their emotions. The bride looked anxiously at him.
"What's worrying you, Jack?"
He laughed. "I'm not worrying, girl. I'm only thinking of Yellow Sky." She understood, and her face turned red again. They shared a sense of slight guilt that developed a finer tenderness. They looked at each other with eyes softly glowing. but Potter often laughed the same nervous laugh. The deep red color upon the bride's face did not lessen.
"We're nearly there," he said.
As the train began to slow, they moved forward in the car. The long line of cars moved into the station, a yellow sky.
"The train has to get water here," said Potter from a tight throat and face, as one announcing death.
Before the train stopped, his eye had searched the station, and he was glad and surprised to see there was no one there except the station master.
"Come on, girl," said Potter with a thick voice.
As he helped her down, they each laughed in a strained manner. He took her bag and told his wife to hold his arm. As they hurried away, he saw that the station master had turned and was running toward them, waving his arms. Potter laughed, and sighed as he laughed when he realized the first effect of his wedding upon Yellow Sky. He grasped his wife's arm firmly to his side, and they hurried away. The California train was due at Yellow Sky in 21 minutes. There were 6 men in the Weary Gentleman's saloon. One was a salesman who talked a great deal and rapidly. 3 were Texans who did not care to talk at that time, and 2 were Mexican sheep farmers who did not usually talk in the saloon. The saloon keeper's dog lay in front of the door. His head was resting on his feet, and he glanced sleepily here and there with the ready watchfulness of a dog that is sometimes kicked. Across the sandy street were some bright green grass spots, so wonderful in appearance next to the burning sands in the hot sun. At the cooler side of the railroad station, a man without a coat sat in a chair leaned back against the building. He smoked his pipe. The waters of the Rio Grande River circled near the town, and beyond it could be seen great flatlands. Except for the busy salesman and his companions in the saloon, Yellow Sky was sleeping. The salesman leaned easily upon a table and told many tales with the confidence of a storyteller who has found new listeners. He was interrupted by a young man who suddenly appeared in the open door. He cried, "Scratchy Wilson's drunk, and he has started to make trouble." The 2 Mexicans at once put down the glasses and disappeared through the rear door of the saloon. The salesman, not understanding the importance of the warning, jokingly answered, "All right, old man, suppose he has. Come in and have a drink anyhow." But the information had made such an apparent impression upon everyone in the room that the salesman was forced to see its importance. All had become instantly serious.
"Well," he said, filled with mystery, "what is this?"
His 3 companions started to tell him, but the young man at the door stopped them.
"It means, my friend," he answered as he came into the saloon, "that for the next 2 hours this town won't be very healthy."
The saloon keeper went to the door and locked it. Reaching out of the window, he pulled in heavy wooden boards which covered the windows and locked there. The salesman was looking from one to another.
"What is this, anyhow?" he cried. "You don't mean it's going to be a gunfight?"
Come back to American Stories next week for the second half of The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky by Stephen Crane.
That's all the time we have for today's show, but join us again tomorrow for another VOA Learning English program. Thanks for listening. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Brian Lynn.